Sally, hello. Thank you so much for joining
Hello.
me tonight. I feel like we were just in Cape Town,
I
just
know.
like yesterday.
Oh,
And then now
I'm
we're
still
like.
debating if I'm gonna go back next time I go to New York.
You better. You better. I better see you. Anyways, Sally, it's such an honor to have you today. I'm so excited for our conversation. There's a lot to talk about and so many exciting things to talk about. But first, if you could first please introduce yourselves to everybody. Thank you.
Yeah, very briefly. Hi, I'm Sally Choi, MD. I'm a radiology resident physician, currently PGY3, and I also do social media on the side for fun.
What a boss. What a boss. Anyways, I created this series just to really introspect more about healthcare workers' journeys and breaking down their specialties for people who may not know. And I've always been wanting to have a radiologist on and to talk about radiology, and we're finally here. First, I want to break down your journey into medicine. People don't know the whole medical process is such a long road, right?
Yeah.
It's undergrad and all the requirements going to med school and then med school and then residency and then fellowship you choose to do so. Where did this initial inspiration to do medicine come from? Was it a family, friend, personal experience?
So I will say, everyone, when you ask them why they want to do medicine, everyone's actual answer is to help people, but we have to come up with different reasons, different ways to word it or whatever. Okay, so the real answer is to help people is like the initial, like when I'm a kid and I'm like, what do I want to be when I grow up or whatever. I will say, like, just as you're growing up through adolescence and young adulthood and you're trying to figure out what you want to do with your life, one question that I would ask myself a lot was just what I would feel fulfilled doing, because in reality, almost every single job that exists helps people. Everything, like, either serves people or moves society forward or moves technology forward, whatever it is. But just for me to have a career where I can, like, feel that very directly and not have to conceptualize it too far, which is funny for me to say since I'm in radiology. And for most people, that's like the one where that's the most far removed from the initial, like, inspiration of going into medicine.
Yeah, and we'll talk all about it
Yeah.
tonight. Which, like, even with that sense of fulfillment, right? And just, I guess, that sense of reward, even just helping people in whatever way or capacity that is. Again, the road to medicine is so long with so many entailed sacrifices, right? Whether it be time or effort or the years go by, even financial for many, right? Given that, do you have any regrets in pursuing this field of medicine at all?
So I'll touch on some of what you said before the regrets part, and then I'll talk about that part. So everyone knows that the training for medicine is really long. It shouldn't really be a surprise to, like, anyone who's going into it if they've looked into it a bit before committing. But there are just some things that you find out, because neither of my parents were physicians. I guess actually a lot of people who go into medicine this generation are kind of like generational, like their parents were physicians too. But if you're the first one in the family or the first generation in the family, there are just a lot of things you don't discover until you're in it. And I'll just say what a couple of those things are, or a couple of what they were for me, which one big one is, like, you can go all through medical school and you're not guaranteed a residency. And for those of y'all who don't know, after medical school, you get your medical degree, but for the practice of it, you're required to do at least some training in a residency, but usually a full training in residency to be board certified and everything. Like, last year and the years before that, about one in 15 medical students, MD seniors, don't match into a residency spot. And if you're a DO senior, unfortunately, there is bias still in the medical community about that, but the match rate's closer to like one in 12 or so a little worse. And then if you're an international applicant, it's like so much worse than that. But that's just something a lot of people, especially the first generations, discover in the middle of the training. And I feel like when you're also making a decision in high school and college, you learn, like, oh, you trained for so long and that kind of thing, but you don't really understand the true long-term financial implications of that until you're like an adult and you're like, oh,
I
like,
agree. Yeah.
things cost this much, and like, oh, that's what an interest rate means on loans, or like, oh my God, what is compound interest in the stock market? Like, getting in 5 years or 10 years later, that kind of thing. So those are also things that are kind of a surprise, or that you end up learning through growing up and also in training. For regrets, for myself, I am a very happy-go-lucky person, just in general. So this comes with a grain of salt, but, and also note that I, like, love, love, love my job. So I really can't recall any regrets in my medical training, because I feel like where I am now is exactly where I want to be. I can't imagine anything that I would have changed to to get to here. Yeah. Because, I mean, if I change like little things like this or that or whatever, why does it matter? Like, I'm still here. So.
Yeah, I love that. And as you said that you love your job, I want to talk about that job as radiology. I mean, we'll talk about the memes later on in this conversation, but I want to touch on just the field of radiology itself. For those who may not know, what is it? What does it really entail? What is the premise of the whole field? And consequently, what is it about that field that you're like, I'm going to be a radiologist?
Yeah. So say a random person that I meet for the first time was like, oh, wow. Like, so what does a radiologist do again when I tell them my job? I'm a radiology resident, by the way. I'm not claiming to be a fully board certified radiologist. Yeah, I'm just talking about the field. I just kind of briefly explained that we're the physicians that read all of the imaging, I guess most of the imaging in the hospital. And I say it includes like all the x-rays, the CTs, the MRIs. We also do some imaging guided procedures, as well as some other imaging modalities. And then usually that's like, no one really asked anymore after that. They just wanted to know what I did as a job. And then I'm actually pretty different from most radiology residents because I've been wanting to do radiology for like since I was 18 years old. So that's 10 years. I'm telling you how old I am. That was 10 years ago. And most, I would say like the vast majority of medical students who go into radiology don't choose until maybe their third or fourth year of medical school, for whatever reasons those are. But mostly it's just that there's no exposure of this field to the general populace. Because when you think about a physician and when you go to the hospital, even you like hardly ever meet a radiologist unless they're doing the procedure. But like if you're there for some medicine issue, then you never meet them. But when I was a college freshman, I was in this health science scholar thing in college. And at one of our meetings, we had a radiologist come and he walked us through some cases. And I was like, wow, what is this? Because truly nothing else is like radiology. Mm-hmm. And to me, I thought it was like so fun. He would show us like a patient came with this, show us the image. And then he's like, what do you see? Well, the answer is this. And then he would go on to the next case. And I really love that the radiologist could like give the answer. And I also, a few other things I like about it. I don't know if this is going to be the next question or anything, but I also liked that you see a case, you give the answer, and then you like, you're on to the next one. Mm-hmm. And you just keep going like that. So that is why I like the field and generally what the field is.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you're right. I think it's a field that, let's say when you say medicine, right? I feel like the first image that people come to mind, it's like a hospitalist, right? They're walking through the hospital halls or
surgeon,
medicine rounds, dear God. And also like, or maybe a cardiologist in a clinic, right? Radiologist? I feel like there was one Grey's Anatomy episode where they're even like, are you a doctor? Like, are you part of that? And we'll talk more about that, obviously, the life of the radiologist. But radiology in itself, what is the path to this, given that we may, maybe people outside of medicine may not know, right?
Yeah.
What is the path to radiology? Is there a possible subspecialty afterwards? And if so, which one would you want to do?
Yeah. So actually, this is something that surprises a lot of people too, is the path of radiology. So first, we need to complete basic medical training just to be a physician. So that entails the bachelor in America, the bachelor degree and the medical degrees. So approximately 8 years for people, unless they graduate college early. And after your medical training, you do a residency. Diagnostic radiology residency is 5 years. And everyone's like so surprised to hear that radiology is 5 years long for residency training, because that's also like the length of general surgery and like other specialties like pediatrics or internal medicine or family medicine. Those are 3 years. But yeah, now that I'm in radiology, I still feel like 5 years is short to learn everything. And then after you finish the five-year residency, pretty much everybody, like over 90% of people, do a one-year fellowship, 1 to 2 year, but most are 1 year. And so in total, the radiology training is PGY6, so post-grad year 6. So I guess like with the 8 years of pre-residency schooling and then the 6 years of training, it's 14 years after high school in total. Yeah.
Short time. Well, can you take us more into those different fellowships that radiologists can do?
Yeah. And the one that I'm interested in, again, this is the one that I've been interested in since I was 18 years old. So I want to do neuro. I've always been interested in neuro, just in general, like even back in college, I majored in neuroscience and that kind of stuff. And I even considered neurology for a little bit before I was solidifying my decision for radiology. And I don't know, there are various reasons why I like radiology better than that. Mm-hmm. Not that neurology is that bad, but I also worked at a neurology clinic for a year before medical school, because I graduated college in 3 years. Mm-hmm. And then in what would have been my senior year, I was working in a clinic. And granted, it was a movement disorder clinic, mm-hmm. which means it was a lot of Parkinson's patients and the kind of patients who don't get better, but you just slow them getting worse. And I was like, man, I don't know if I could do that every day. Like, I would either want to see people get better or like do something else. And so neuro is a specialty I like, mm-hmm. because it's kind of acute. You get stroke alerts and strokes, mm-hmm. you need to act on really fast. You see all kinds of pathology within the brain and the spine, mm-hmm. all kinds of different masses. And some things, if you catch early, you can really change the prognosis of the mm-hmm. patient. And some of the other subspecialties, there are a ton. It's actually a very, very, very broad field. I can tell you kind of more what the daily life looks like for the different subspecialties, but there's mammography, mm-hmm. there's abdomen, which is like body, all of the organs within your abdomen. There's chest/thoracic. Interventional radiology is now its own kind mm-hmm. of branch, mm-hmm. but we do some interventional radiology training and diagnostic radiology too. Musculoskeletal. I swear I'm going to forget one, and then people who are into it are going to be so offended. Should have made a list before.
They know who they are.
Emergency medicine is also a subspecialty mm-hmm. that you can do fellowship in. Well, I'm just going to leave it there.
We'll leave it there. We'll put in the notes. But yeah, I mean, radiology seems to be such a diverse field, right? And I guess all of those fellowships and subspecialties, obviously their foundation is really in this 5 years of diagnostic radiology, right? And so I want you to take me into your daily life as a diagnostic radiology resident physician. What do you do on a daily basis? Like, I guess, especially because it's radiology, what kind of imaging do you usually see in residency?
Yeah. Oh, one specialty I forgot was nuclear medicine.
There we go.
Gonna throw that one in there.
Hey.
So in residency, I would say radiology residency compared to other residency is pretty like soft or pretty cush or whatever it is. Most of my days are kind of like a normal workday hours from 8 a.m. to 4:30 or 5. And that's a typical day shift. In whatever subspecialty I'm in, it looks a little bit different. Sometimes you might have a 7 a.m. conference or a lecture or something like that. And I'm going to say that what it would look like in like neuro, body, chest, nuclear medicine, and only the procedural specialties are a little bit different. So when I'm training on interventional radiology, I get there at 7 instead of 8 just to like look at the procedure board, see what we have that day, and patients will already start coming in. So I'll go consent them and tell them about the procedure and that kind of thing. And we get started at 8 with the procedures. And on interventional radiology, I might finish a little bit later, like 6 o'clock or something like that. When I'm working emergency radiology shifts for night shift, which I'm actually on my night shift rotation now, but I'm on my days off in between. That's like from 6:30 p.m. to 7:30 in the morning. So a little bit of a longer stretch, but it's okay. Everyone, the nights need to be staffed. And we do a lot of that kind of more in the central part of our training year. So you don't have to be doing it at the very, very, very end. Mm. And you still have some time to build up your experience before you're like pretty independent on nights and kind of independently function. So I would say most of what we read across, like if I just say generally across, would be CTs, computed tomography, which are the like slices through the body in the different planes, and plain films. And then the specialties that are very heavy on MRI are neuro and like a little bit of MSK. Mm. And nuclear medicine is a specialty of diagnostic radiology that is, they have all kinds of like a bunch of different imaging modalities, like PET scans, or they have different tests to look for very, very specific things, to look at the heart, to see if the gallbladder, cystic duct is inflamed or anything like that. So nuclear medicine is kind of its own ballpark. And for mammography, obviously the most common imaging we see are mammograms, screening mammograms for women or men who present with issues or concerns. And mammography is a field, I'm talking a long time. There are so many different subspecialties in radiology, but in mammography, it's kind of, that's another specialty besides interventional radiology that sees patients. So I had my mammography rotation a couple months ago, and I was seeing like probably like 6 to 15 patients a day. Because we run mammo clinic. Mm-hmm. We just don't write the typical notes like normal clinic notes, because we write it in our reports for that day, our imaging reports for what happened and what we talked about. So that's the specialty where you see a lot of people, you're reading mammograms, and you're doing a lot of breast biopsies. Mm-hmm. So any given day, we might have around 6 breast biopsies to do. Yeah, I'll say while we're talking about procedures, obviously, there's interventional radiology who does vascular-based procedures. There's mammography, which I talked about, with a lot of biopsies, that kind of thing. And for musculoskeletal radiology, we can do things like steroid joint injections in the shoulder, in the hip. A lot of patients who come for hip steroid injections, it's kind of like a, let's try this before we decide on a total hip replacement, because those surgeries are very hard, especially for older patients. Yeah. Recover from. Mm-hmm. And neuro does, there's a range of neurovascular procedures. Mm-hmm. But I guess the most base, like consistent procedure for neuro are lumbar punctures. Mm-hmm. If they're more challenging to just do on the floor with the palpated landmarks.
I often wish I had perfect vision. There is so much intricacy in life and beauty in the world around me that I often miss because my view can get so blurry. Though I had glasses for years, I opted never to wear them because of the embarrassing indentations and marks they left behind on my face. Kovri seeks to target this common struggle within the eyewear market. Kovri is a 100% AAPI woman-owned inclusive eyewear brand designed for comfort, offering a wide range of sunwear and specs with prescription lens options. With their signature elevated fit that features longer nose pads, a reduced frame curvature, and a narrowed nose bridge to elevate the frame, Kovri is designed to better complement diverse facial features, such as low nose bridges and high cheekbones, for an effortless fit. Beyond this, the premium handcrafted frames are made from plant-based acetate and lenses with 100% UV protection. Find your perfect fit with their offers of a home and virtual try-on. With the code FRANZ, that's FRANZ, you can get $20 off any frame you like on shopkovri.com. See the world's beauty more comfortably with Kovri. This offer is valid in one frame per order, cannot be combined with any other offers, and is limited to one use per customer. There are luxuries in life that see beyond material things. Practices like self-care and skincare can be an oasis in the whirlwinds and busyness of life. But what if there exists a harmony between material and immaterial luxuries? House of M Beauty is a saffron-infused luxury skincare line that harnesses the antioxidant, vitamin C-rich, anti-inflammatory, and antibacterial power of the highest quality medicinal-grade saffron. They are a clean treatment skincare line suitable for sensitive and postpartum skin. Their unique and consciously crafted formulations maximize the potency of medicinal saffron to calm and soothe sensitive skin while brightening and targeting skin concerns. From their skin polish, to the Miracle Serum, to the Glow Jelly Mask, and the Silk Night Concentrate. Experience the luxurious transformation saffron can bring to your skin with the code FRANZ20, that's FRANZ20, for 20% off your first order on houseofmbeauty.com. Also available at Nordstrom nationwide. As a nurse, I am on my feet, alert for 12 hours or more each day. There is no space for drowsiness or lethargy in my job because my patient's well-being is at stake. Sometimes, you just need the extra energy boost from coffee. Robusta coffee offers 2 times more caffeine and antioxidants with 60% less sugar. But did you know that thanks to its climate and fertile volcanic soil, Vietnam is the world's 2nd largest coffee producer and the number 1 grower of Robusta? Nguyen Coffee Supply is America's first specialty, woman-owned Vietnamese coffee company set to change the future of coffee through sustainability, diversity, and inclusion. They only roast coffee beans that are hand-picked at peak ripeness from direct trade Vietnamese farms to produce sweet and flavorful coffee without any additives, flavorings, or oils. Get your own velvety coffee experience for 15% off your order with the code FRANZ15, that's FRANZ15, at NguyenCoffeeSupply.com. As you can see, it's like the expanse of images that radiologists read. Mm-hmm. And what the procedures you do is, I mean, such a huge array, right? And you specifically mentioned imaging modalities, which means there's more than one. There's definitely more than one type mm-hmm. of imaging, right? And because you are the first radiologist in our podcast, you have the biggest honor of taking us through those imaging modalities.
Yeah.
I guess I'll say the most common ones, and I feel like even me, who has been a patient before too, or even the general population, right? When their doctors, I guess, are like, oh, get a CAT scan, get an MRI, we tend to just go and get it done, right? Without knowing what really is it for. Obviously, different imagings have different indications, have different reasons, and we're looking for different things. So we'll go through some of the most common, and then you just tell me, why is it usually ordered, and what are you looking for to read as a radiologist, right? Let's start with an x-ray, I guess. Very common, very simple.
Everyone knows it's what they like put up on TV when they're looking at new patients who come in. Mm-hmm. So things that we can see very well on x-ray are bones and kind of the lungs when we shoot a chest x-ray. When we shoot an x-ray, what happens is I'm not going to explain the full physics of it, but essentially it's like a superimposed single image of the entire field of view for density, kind of. And so that's why bones are white. Bones are the most dense, so bones are white, and then air is the least dense, so air is black. So that's why the lungs look black on chest x-rays. And a lot of times we either get extremity x-rays because they're in a trauma, like a car accident, and we think that they might have broken something. And then that's our first attempt at finding it. Chest x-ray, pretty much anyone who has shortness of breath gets a chest x-ray. Mm-hmm. You're looking like, is there pneumonia there? Are they in fluid overload? Do they have pleural effusions? Mm-hmm. Is this an exacerbation episode of their heart failure? Or have they not had dialysis in 5 days or 10 days or however long they have to come back to the ED in frequency? So those are x-rays. And then I'll say the next one we can talk about are CTs, because those are also ones that people are pretty familiar with. They see on TV shows, that kind of thing, when they're like standing there and the patient's on the table and they're like, oh my God, like, look at this. And it's like an oval of the body with different organs in it. And so CT is similar to x-ray, and it visualizes density in slices through our body. So again, bone is going to be bright, air is going to be dark, and then everything in between is a shade of gray. Well, technically the air is also a shade of gray and the bones are a shade of gray, but and this kind of gives us a better like localized look at what we're looking at, because an x-ray is like everything all at once and we only have one picture, whereas a CT we have all these little slices and the technologists reformat it for us. So we see slices this way, we see slices this way, we see slices this way. And so we can kind of tell exactly where something is, which organ something is going on and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I love it. And then we also talk a lot about MRIs, right? Mm-hmm. People are like, oh, I feel like I'm going to a chamber and I'm claustrophobic. What is this big enclosed donut for? What are we looking for?
So the bulk of an MRI, essentially it uses a very, very strong magnet. That's why there are limitations on what kind of metal you can bring into the room, because it will rip through your clothes. it's a very, very strong magnet. You can look up YouTube videos of physicists just playing with MRI machines, and they'll put like one of those scales that measures pounds of force, and they'll like put a dumbbell on it and measure like 2,000 pounds of force of pull from the MRI. But briefly, MRIs use strong magnets, and then they detect the change in rotational axis of protons in water. And so the magnet does its thing, the rotational axis of water protons flip around, and the machine detects that, and then it kind of scales the images in a different way than CT or x-ray. But it can give us like really good resolution. It allows us to characterize things that we just can't see well on the density-based imaging, and like different characteristics, like how cystic is a mass or how cellular is a mass and that kind of thing, to help us go down the tree and say we think it's this.
I mean, I feel like when someone is going through an MRI, like, no one's thinking about the protons and all of this, right? It's so interesting how it just science and medical technology works to make this all possible, right? And I think one also that many people may not know about or how it works is the PET scan, right? Mm-hmm. Can you tell us more about the PET scan?
So there are lots of different kinds of PET scans, actually. So the idea is that you have a radio tracer, which sounds really scary, but all it means is that it emits energy that we can detect. And it's like tagged to target a certain kind of cell. And so the one that's most common is like FDG. It's a version of glucose. So essentially cells that are eating up a lot of glucose, multiplying out of control, that kind of thing, will take up this tracer and then it will glow bright on our images. There are some things that normally take up a lot of tracer, like the brain uses a lot of energy, the kidneys, the heart. But if we were to see like a glowing spot in the middle of a lung lobe, then we'd be like, oh, that looks not normal. And it helps localize maybe things we couldn't see on other imaging and that kind of thing. There are also more specific, really specific ones that have been developed. Mm-hmm. There's PSMA, which is like a prostate-specific antigen. And so in patients with prostate cancer, if you want to see like how extensive it is, the involved pieces of bone will glow really bright, that kind of thing.
Got it. And I guess that's the last one, which is one I guess that many people get commonly, is an ultrasound.
Oh,
I know there's different types. Inherently, what is it and what is it for?
It's like when bats fly and then they use echolocation, or when dolphins are swimming and they use their sonic waves. So it's based on the transmission of sonographic waves or like sound waves, as most people would know them. Same thing, like it gives the waves and then some things bounce the waves, some things let the waves through, and then the machine detects that. So like water, fluid-based things, just sound waves go straight through it, just like sound waves go through the ocean. And so those are very dark. Bone sound waves bounce off, and so those things are very bright, and then you can't see anything behind the bone because the bone blocked all the sound waves, so there's like a shadow and that kind of thing.
That's so cool. It feels like part of a science fiction movie, right? If you think of how all of these imaging modalities work. With these imaging modalities, we're definitely, the doctor's ordering them for something, right? We're trying to find something in this imaging that's something that we're worried about or something we just want to see. Would you say that there are some possible diseases that's easily diagnosable by imaging alone? And if so, what are those?
So I would say most common diagnoses, those diagnoses like heart failure or pneumonia or liver disease, that kind of thing, we were diagnosing that way before we had all of this imaging to help supplement the decision making. So I will say most diseases, the diagnosis is mostly clinical. And then our imaging is either like a hard like confirmation or maybe suggest something else. On imaging, we can see like almost everything. Like name a disease, we could probably see it. A stroke, maybe you can't see it in the first couple hours or so, but like old strokes, we can see bleeds really light up, like hemorrhages, intracranial hemorrhages. We can see evidence of past surgery. We can see if you have pain after you eat, if you're having gallstones, if you have gallbladder sludge. We can see the effects of cirrhosis, of kidney disease. Your kidney looks different. We can see like the size. We can see everything.
You can even see an echocardiogram, a clot just lying there ready to be a pulmonary embolism any second now, right?
Yeah, we can see like tiny clots in the in the vessels of the lungs, maybe not too tiny, in the closer vessels of the lungs.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Yeah, I feel like it's really more of like a confirmation of the clinical presentations that most people feel, right? Like, oh, maybe someone with heart failure, they've been feeling this or that already, and an echocardiogram will show, your ejection fraction is this, right? And stuff like that. Would you say that in your years of training so far as a radiology resident, what do you think has been the rarest disease or diagnosis you've seen through an imaging?
Rarest. I feel like through medical training, my concept of rare is like cute or whatever, because there are all these diseases where like neurofibromatosis, tuberous sclerosis, or like congenital diseases. We actually see that kind of frequently because I'm in a like large medical center in a large city where a lot of people go. I'm never like surprised when I see something like a congenital disease. I will say there was this one hand radiograph I was looking at, and one of the bones is supposed to be like long and like a peanut shaped kind of thing. It's called the scaphoid. And there was this one kid's hand I was reading, and the scaphoid just looked like a little like Mentos gum, like a disc. And I was like, what is that? Because there are some like developmental diseases, but they look very specific. And so I read this, I don't remember what shift I was reading this on, but I called the pediatric radiologist who was working that day, and I was like, do you know what this is? And he's like, nope. And I was like, okay. So they're actually some things that we don't really know what they are, but then like we're like, oh well, it's not causing any issues. Yeah. Like it's not broken.
Yeah.
It doesn't have the remodeling of avascular necrosis. The bone isn't like decaying or rotting or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So just kind of describe it and be like, whatever you make of it.
You know, it's so interesting as you say this, it kind of make it seem like radiologists have like can see the secrets that's hidden from everybody else, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's things that you can't see physically, but the radiologist will see it through the imaging, right? Or anyone else knows in the care team, like the radiologist will be the first one to see it. But I feel like, especially within the name of radiology itself, I mean, I think a lot of people's concern is radiation, uh-huh. right? I mean, pregnant people, we don't let them go here and this or that. Are you ever worried about your exposure to radiation through mm-hmm. all the medical imaging you do? And I guess for those who may not know, what would be the concern for radiation exposure?
Yeah, I actually get this comment a lot when I talk about what I do on social media, and they're like, oh, but like, isn't it kind of dangerous because the radiation and that kind of thing? I will say, as the physician radiology staff, a lot of the exposure is like shifted to the technicians, because when someone's getting a CT, like I'm not there when they're getting the CT. All I do is get the images once they're done. The technicians who receive the most amount of radiation are nuclear medicine technicians, because these radio tracers that we put to be able to see things in glow, they are radioactive. And so just because the technician's the one like administering the egg salad sandwich, mm-hmm. the radioactive sandwich that the patients eat for the study mm-hmm. and that kind of thing, they're the ones that get most exposed. Mm-hmm. The subspecialties in radiology where the physicians get the most exposure are interventional radiology, because you use fluoroscopy, which is like boom, boom, boom x-rays in sequential x-rays, like a movie.
Mm-hmm.
So like 30 frames per second, that kind of thing. And you can see live where your wires are going. So mm-hmm. interventional radiologists probably get the most radiation exposure. And then any other subspecialty that uses fluoroscopy or like anything that we're there for the imaging, we get a little bit. And there are actually very, very strict rules for the amount of radiation exposure that we're allowed to get. So all of us on our badge, we have a tracker, a monthly tracker. We keep it on our chest. We switch it out every month. And there's an annual occupational limit for radiation. No one ever gets close to what that exposure is.
Yeah.
And if you go over the exposure for some reason, we actually have a lot of physicists in our department. They're PhDs specialized in radiation physics.
Mm.
But if any of them say like, oh, you're over your limit this year, like that's it. You don't do any procedures for the rest of the year. It's like very, very strict. There's no like, oh, like just put the tracker down and like rub in for this procedure. There's none of that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're pregnant, you have a threshold that's 10 times lower than me, who's not pregnant right now. So it's very strict and very safe, I would say. And also, of course, we wear protective equipment and that kind of thing for all the procedures.
Think of for protection, right? And also for the techs, right? Who really are the ones who receive all this.
Yeah.
I guess another question would be, if one was to be exposed without protection, of have like reached that limit, do we know of like the effects that could have on the body?
Oh yeah, there also, this isn't like just for radiologists, but people in general, we know that like at this many grays of exposure to a spot of skin, you'll start getting burning, like your skin will start burning and peeling and that kind of thing. And then at this many grays, you'll get organ failure, which is like nuclear reactor level of of the rays. So we also do have like scaled effects of radiation that have been studied.
Wow. So we're talking a lot about the logistics and specifics of medical imaging and, you know, radiology itself. As we're saying this, people's image of radiologists are in a dark room and they're reading the x-rays or the scans. And, you know, there was one meme I saw a few years ago where it's showing a radiologist that's in a deep, dark basement with no windows and just reading the scans, right, and reading the x-rays. Would you say that this is an accurate portrayal of radiologists, this isolation from the rest of the healthcare sphere? And that being said, do you feel left out from the rest of the healthcare sphere because you're a radiologist?
And that's like a super common, like, oh, radiologists are always stuck in the basement or like in the back corner of a hospital. I will say, in terms of the setting of that meme or that idea, it's pretty accurate because we are kind of stuck wherever, but we're not isolated. We're constantly calling clinicians. If we see something critical, we like have to let them know, because if we write the report, who knows, like people aren't just always like sifting through their patients' charts or whatever. So I'm talking to clinicians like all day. So not very isolated, especially when I'm working the night shifts on emergency radiology. We have like me and the stroke resident for that week, because I was reading neuro scans. We were like this, like he came in so much and I'll be like, oh, hey, insert physician name here, who I'm not going to say on this live.
Hello.
Unknown whoever.
Yeah, I feel like maybe reading the scans so accurate, but yeah, you're right, like you talk to other clinicians all the time, especially I guess if there's something urgent, right? Especially in my job where we have a CAT scan, like a coronary CAT scan, and like the radiologist would always call like, oh, you know, this person has a major blockage, it's like we gotta do the next steps. You know, and I think another question also is, aside from the interaction of the radiologist with other clinicians, but the interactions with the patients themselves, right? You previously mentioned, like, you know, I guess in the mammogram, right, aspect, you got to see several patients. In general, how do you think is the level of interaction between radiologists and their patients? And so how does that interaction look like?
So for procedure-based specialties or clinic-based, like mammography, it's a completely different discussion than if it's neuroradiology or abdomen radiology. The nature of mammography, because we're looking for cancer, and we tell them that we do the biopsies, we're the ones who inform them of the results. And so there are a lot of like really difficult, like a lot of crying. Like I definitely cried with some patients, which there's like a really close connection in terms of that way, just because the nature of the subspecialty. Interventional radiology, it's also very scary because a lot of the procedures are like cowboy. Like we'll figure it out when we get there. Like this is our goal. We're going to get there however we can get there. For neuroradiology, body, chest, nuclear medicine, you also see patients and like discuss their thing with them because they're there for several hours. But for a lot of what people think of just hospital radiology, you don't really see the patients. Like, so when I'm on those rotations, my whole day is like reading, reading, scrolling, 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 reading, reading, calling clinicians and like at my desk. And I actually wanted to talk about, I feel like that's a reason why so many women don't choose radiology as their specialty, just because like the nature of it and like wanting to have that patient interaction is the number one reason why people don't pick this field. Also, it is certainly like one of the most competitive fields because it has a good flexible lifestyle, which is not a given in the practice of medicine, and it's compensated well, which is also not a given in the practice of medicine. And so it's popular for those reasons, but I feel like especially among women who are more like wanting the interpersonal relationship thing, there are parts of radiology that you have that, like I was already talking about, but I will say like that is a hard stop for you. It's going to be pretty hard to get through the training of like everything else, because that's where you spend maybe 75% of your time. For me though, like I guess that never was a barrier to me wanting to do this, because even if I don't see the patient face-to-face, I understand that I'm still participating in dozens, some nights even hundreds of patients' care a day. And it's not like in an insignificant way either. Imaging, everyone's waiting for what the radiology report is going to say. What we say changes the management plan. And so for me, it's like so clear that I'm participating in the patient's care. But anyways, that's definitely a reason why so many women don't pick the field. And right now, the makeup of practicing radiologists is roughly like 3/4 men and 1/4 women. And what's interesting is that in most fields, the proportion of women has increased as more women are going through medical training, and, you know, like not as many women were in training in the 1980s or before that. But in radiology, that ratio has stayed pretty consistent. So even among trainees, around 1/4 are women and the rest are men. I don't know, I just want more women to go into it, because I think it's a great field. And sometimes it even feels like there are less than 25% women.
Depending on as many.
I know, what the makeup of your program is or something, whatever it happened to be that year. But I'm always like team girls for radiology.
Yeah, we need more, right? I mean, you're right. I feel like that physical interaction with the patients may be a hard stop for others, but you're right, like you are fully part of the whole process mm-hmm. of this patient's treatment, right? I feel like it's kind of like a bittersweet thing because radiology can be, it's like a double-edged sword source of both potential hope that, oh, there's nothing, I didn't see anything, but at the same time it's like, oh, we saw this right? And I think just that imaging alone kind of jump starts the journey of the patient, right? Like, what are the next steps we have to do? Yeah. What's the treatment plan now? Do we have to revert some things? Do we have to start new things? It's such a very intricate and complex field, right? It's also so diverse, mm-hmm. which is so amazing. Given all of that, what would you say would be your most favorite part about the field of radiology?
Well, I'll talk about what you said before I answer that. So when you're like, oh, like what you say, like double-edged sword, again, like because we can see so many more things now than we could see 30 years ago or before CTs, there's so many cases of people just coming in like, oh, I have abdominal pain, and then we find like a pancreatic mass or like an ovarian mass is like 20 centimeters, like, and they kind of just never had a look inside or had a physical examination to check it out. And also, like, we can see a lot on imaging, but also, like, we can sometimes not see what the answer is. And a lot of that is kind of more of the clinical diagnosis things, but I know especially with the challenging patient presentations where it doesn't fall into this really easy jacket, easy list of symptoms for a diagnosis, it can be really frustrating to also get a scan and be like, oh, everything's normal. But the patient's like, I know I'm not normal. Yeah. I know there's something. And then my favorite part of the field, the favorite part of me practicing the field, I honestly just think it's really fun because you see what a patient comes in with and you have an idea of what you're looking for, but a lot of times you have no idea what you're going to see. And I really like going back to that college lecture. I like that I can give an answer or find something to explain what the patient is feeling. And so say a patient comes in with stroke symptoms and you look inside the head and there's no stroke. And sometimes you can't see stroke, that's fine. But you look like really closely, the patient may have had a car accident like a couple of days before or something. And you see a fracture that goes through the temporal bone and then like just touches the facial canal where the facial nerve runs. And you're like, that's the reason. Like, that's the reason why they have facial droop on the left side. And their hearing is muffled because the facial nerve innervates like one cystopedius muscle in the auditory system. And you're like, wow, like, literally, I just saw the little line touch the other little line, and I have an explanation for why the patient is like not able to smile straight or swallow their water and that kind of thing.
Being in scrubs the whole shift and for days at work can sometimes strip you of your sense of fashion and self-expression. But instilling a bit of design and color does not hurt to let your personality shine through your uniform. V Coterie is a leading provider of healthcare jewelry and accessories for playful everyday wear, from pins to badge-real charms and medical specialty-specific necklaces. With their creative process paralleling the founder's background in dentistry, V Coterie was founded to spark the genius within you, redefining the traditional boundaries for jewelry and accessories. They believe fashion can celebrate curiosity and the pursuit of knowledge while allowing you to express your truest self. From the curious student to a confident clinician or even a kidney transplant survivor, V Coterie is here to celebrate you no matter where the journey takes you. Get 15% off your first order with the code VFriendsOfFrance on VCoterie.com. Find your daily dose of style and make your passion your fashion. As someone with acne-prone skin, I always fear using new moisturizers that may be too heavy on my skin and clog my pores. This is why I love my Aloe Quench by Skin by Anthos, a facial moisturizer made for all skin types, especially for sensitive skin like mine. Made with an oil-free formula using aloe, glycerin, and green tea, it is suitable for acne-prone, oily, or combination skin. Its soothing and paraben-free formula makes it even great for sunburns and patients taking Accutane. Skin by Anthos is the byproduct of the minds and expertise of board-certified dermatology professionals and proud AAPI mothers who saw the need for access to pharmaceutical strength and professional-grade skincare for those with sensitive skin and/or skin of color from the safety and convenience of home.
Experience a regimen tailored to your skin type that is strong enough to deliver medical-grade results for 20% off with the code FRONCEPODCAST when you order on skinbyanthos.com. The sense of taste is so intriguing. A cascade of good memories can wash over you as you experience a flavor you have met before. Founded by Hannah Bae, Helmi, a loving nickname for grandma in Korean, it's a brand of light sparkling beverages that evokes feelings of nostalgia for Koreans and Asians in general, but also curiosity if you are not familiar with certain ingredients and the story behind the flavors. Inspired by traditional Korean flavors through family recipes and made with real fruits and spices, Helmi's debut flavor, Cinnamon Ginger Jujube Persimmon, is a sparkling take on Korea's beloved sujongwa, a sweetened spice punch that has been brewed for generations to aid digestion and is shared during Korea's most festive moments. It's their version of a healthier, lighter ginger ale. With the code FRANZ, that's F-R-A-N-Z, you can get 15% off your first order on drinkhelmi.com. Partake in honoring roots, strengthening ancestral connections, and celebrating hyphenated identities with unique, refreshing, and better-for-you ingredients.
That's just nice to have answers, right? That we find so many people who have not had imaging, right? Sometimes all the things they're feeling, they want an answer to allocate their pain to and all of the things they're feeling. I must say, though, that medical imaging has saved my life. A CAT scan saved my life. During the day after Thanksgiving, I started having abdominal pain. Mm-hmm. And I attributed it to, I ate so much during Thanksgiving. Oh my God, so full. Why am I so gassy? Then the next day, Saturday, I'm like, wow, I'm still having pain from Thursday. And then Sunday, I have a high pain tolerance, obviously. And then Monday, I went to work that day. I still went to work with my stomach aching, my back aching, no fever, no anything. And at the end of the day, the doctor was like, why don't you just get a CAT scan? We have a CAT scan here. I was like, no, I should be fine. I think I'm just gassy. He's like, no, get a CAT scan. And the CAT scan showed that my appendix has been inflamed for 3 days. So I went to the emergency room and they did a contrast CT. And apparently my appendix was 3 times the size of a normal human being.
Oh no.
Guess you got an appendectomy that same night. So she was thick.
Yeah.
She was a thick one. So thank you to CAT scan, to the radiologist, for seeing what could have probably taken my life. And so I am an appendix lighter. And you know, things like that, right? Like for those 3 days, I was just having, because I wasn't having the classic manifestations of appendicitis, right?
Yeah.
So this whole time, I was like, what's going on with me? Why am I having this pain? And the imaging showed the answer, right? And that's so true for so many people, right? Even with pain graver than mine, right? Like, people who probably lived their whole life were thinking, wait, why am I feeling this way? Why is it like, why can't I move my certain arm this way? And the imaging shows the answer. And the answer lies and the radiologist's ability through years and years of training to read it, right? Which is amazing. And I guess that said, do you have a least favorite part about the field of radiology? She just loves it.
I just love my job. It's just the best ever.
Oh my God.
You know how like people ironically, like when people come in and they're like, oh, like how's your day, whatever, and then the attending's like, oh, like, you know, another day in paradise. I'm like, la, la, la. Like, this is actually paradise. But I will say, for the training, like, part of getting to radiology, I just say before, radiology is competitive, and it's getting, like, more competitive. Mm. What is the... I think, like, there was a 60% match rate last year for U.S. medical school seniors, so not even international graduates. And so I like wholeheartedly like love, and I want to recommend to everybody this specialty, but just the unfortunate part of it is like after medical school, like it's possible you may not get into it, but at least the first time.
I
actually know multiple people who didn't match into it.
Yeah.
And sometimes it just takes a couple years. It depends on your determination, but it also depends on your tolerance for risk.
Yeah.
And so if you're like, I'm not going to apply like something that I don't have a good chance or at least a better chance than that of getting into, that's like totally a part of your own decision making process. Yeah. But that's just kind of like a FYI, like, if you want it, just like know that it may not happen the first year. But to me, like, especially with all these years of training, a year is nothing. Mm. Even the fellowship year, I'm like, why not just tack on another year of training? Like,
why don't you say another one? And yeah, another
I'll be like better for it. Yeah. So I thought of something. The practice of medicine, this is actually the case among like almost every single specialty, not just radiology, but even like ENT clinics or a lot of like outpatient medicine, when smaller groups that used to be physician run, like they're all getting bought out across the country, which means also the private practice radiology groups are getting bought out, which just in several small ways means like a little less respect for the physician, for the radiologist working there, a little less compensation or value or that kind of thing. So that's unfortunate. Just because most graduates go private practice, like not many of the jobs are academic. Yeah. And people go private practice because they also pay better. I can't really imagine my life in private practice because I love teaching and I love like talking to residents and medical students, that kind of thing. So I'll probably go academic my whole life, except for maybe a couple years just for the experience. Yeah. So I like know what it's like and that kind of thing. That's kind of like an unfortunate part of the practice of not just radiology, but also just private practice medicine like across the whole country. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I feel like, these are different aspects of, I feel like, especially healthcare in the United States, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Where it's just like all accumulating all together. And I guess a question I wanted to ask you when it comes to that is, given all of that, I mean, despite how broken in our healthcare system is, it's so obvious how much you love your job in this field. What would be your piece of advice to a student or a hopeful physician or even a hopeful radiologist who really want to enter the field but are wondering if healthcare is still worth pursuing given all the flaws in the system?
Yeah, so even though I'm like happy-go-lucky sunshine girl, I'm also very realistic and very logical. So I get these DMs all the time of people asking me about radiology, or like, I'm a high school student, like I don't really know what I want to do yet, but I kind of want to go to medical school, that kind of stuff. So I can't respond to every single DM, but the ones that I do respond to, I essentially tell them, like, recommend it if there's absolutely nothing you can imagine yourself being happy doing. Not just like, oh, like something else you can imagine doing, but like, if you weren't doing medicine, if you can only imagine being unhappy that whole time for the rest of your life, then do medicine. But otherwise, I don't really think it's worth it. If it's for money, it's not worth it. Everyone says, like, if you're just going into medicine for money, like, pick another field that makes more money with less schooling and less, like, financial.
An easier road, with less entailed sacrifices.
Yeah. If you're going in it just to help people and you don't love, like, a lot of other things about it, like I said earlier, almost every single job helps people. You can find, you can like look into other avenues. And then sometimes if someone's just like, oh, I like really, really want to work with patients, like I really want to, and they'll ask about medical school, I'll even say like, oh yeah, that's like totally awesome. We definitely need more doctors. But have you ever like looked into things like PA school, or occupational therapy, physical therapy, like other like healthcare associated fields that aren't just doctor and nursing? Because a lot of people don't know what occupational therapy is, or other kind of fields where they can still work with the patients.
Super.
And my husband and I even talk about, when people ask us like, oh,
so watching, hello.
both of us went to medical school and we're in residency now, and people ask, oh, are you going to like encourage your kids to go into medical school? Both of us are like, no. again, unless they would like cry every day if they weren't a doctor, like, but that's probably not and kind of, I mean, if they want to go into radiology, I would encourage it. But kind of the trajectory of the practice of medicine now, like I said, like in the 80s, maybe it was super lucrative. You were your own boss as a physician. Like, hospital administration existed if you worked academic, but you were still kind of like the top dog. Mm-hmm. If you were outpatient, you owned your own clinics, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's not like that anymore. And also kind of the compensation for everything is not matching to like inflation or living or whatever, but especially for physicians, it's like kind of growing at more of a plateaued rate than the rate of everything else, and especially the cost of schooling, because say in the 80s, like our attendings will be like, oh, my tuition was $450 a semester. We're like, okay, cool. Well, that's why.
That's you think 450 per second now, right?
So I imagine maybe in another 20 years or however many years, that just every little thing about it is going to be like slightly worse, or maybe way worse than it is now. So it's hard to really like push my kid to go into something when it caused my husband and I like so much, like so many tears and like so much sacrifice. And we kind of would want them to like be lifted up in something where they can excel and have a happy, like, I mean, it's not like I'm obviously not unhappy, but kind of just consider like look into other things.
That and thinking all about this and even your daily work and thinking about all the things you've been through from medical school to residency now, it takes a lot of toll, right, on you, like time, again, money, and even like reading scans the whole day.
Yeah.
How do you decompress out of medicine, out of all of it?
So everyone's like, oh, have a hobby and like stick to it or whatever. I'm gonna tell you the real tea. I have hobbies. I'll talk about those later. But like, I had to just under emergently go see a psychiatrist in my medical school training, because I was like super, what is the reported value for 1 in 5 medical trainees are like depressed, but it's probably more than that, especially at specific points of training. Also, depression is, it can be like in different phases of your life. It doesn't mean it needs to be for 3 straight years or anything. Anyways, when I was like super depressed, I kind of had a history of it before, and then I was in one of my rotations, something happened with one of my patients, and I just like couldn't handle. And so I was like violently sobbing, and it didn't stop for 2 hours. And the kind of culture, it's changing now, but even when I was in medical school not that long ago, like you can't just like leave, you have to stay. But the other medical students were like, Sally, like you need to go, like we will cover, like we'll let the attending know, like you just need to go get help. Essentially. And one of my friends, growing up, I was kind of aware of therapy, but never at a point where I was like, oh, you know what would really help is like therapy. It just never like entered my mind. It's like, oh, it's like an option, it's like a treatment option. Until one of my friends was like, oh, you know, like I kind of felt like I was like always humming at this really high frequency, like on the verge of tears all the time, and then therapy really helped me. And then I was like, oh my god, like people go to therapy for this. And then, and so I started therapy my 3rd year of medical school, which is our clinical rotations. And honestly, I think it should be like, instead of an opt-in system, it should be an opt-out system for medical trainees. Like everyone has an appointment available to them. If you don't want it, opt out. To establish care. And so, yeah, I got started on like antidepressants at that time. I didn't need them for like a super, super long term, but just the most like high stress times. Because I wasn't on an SSRI, which you actually have to take consistently for like every single day for months and months for it to take effect. I was on a different one. But yeah, and then in intern year, I needed some help. I actually established care with a psychiatrist in my radiology program too, but it's so classic, like the genetics with environment. My environment got so much better, where I'm just like flying every day now. Like I'm just so happy, so on cloud nine. But so I had a few sessions with this therapist in my advanced program for radiology. And then the last one, she was like, yeah, like we don't really have anything to talk about. And I was like, yeah, she's like, you can just like come back like as you need, or like, and I was like, cool. So my therapist told me I don't need therapy anymore. Don't know about that, but and then my decompressing hobbies, like I power lift. I really like weightlifting. I like being super, super strong. In medical school, I won my bench press competition in the school system. I like being super strong. So that's a big thing. And then the other thing I do to decompress is watch shows, lots and lots of shows. So like any Korean drama, any anime, only the most popular American shows. I don't really love all of the American shows, but kind of the more sitcom-y things like Modern Family and Fresh Off the Boat and that kind of stuff. So that's my big like activities to decompress is exercise and watching shows.
Which Sally gave me a list of for anime, which I still have to start.
Yeah,
I can't wait. And Sally, thank you so much for, I mean, I learned so much from imaging standpoint, also for your transparency. I mean, I feel like this is also what we need, right? Like healthcare workers and social media too, which I also is one of the huge goals for the podcast, is to just make it just like a FaceTime call, right? Like someone says that 160 bench though, see it.
That person's always commenting on my weightlifting, if I ever have weightlifting in my content. He was like, what's the bench?
I love it. Well, Sally, I mean, I can't believe over an hour passed by already.
I know, that's so fast.
I know. Talking about radiology and even life outside radiology, it's just so amazing to see someone who's just so passionate about what they do and what's yet to come. And this is such an honor to have you with me tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. And You better come back to New York soon. Hello. Yeah. You
better. There's a really quick way to get there. The bullet train.
The bullet train. I know. Well, Sally, thank you so, so much. I hope you watch a show tonight. And watch a K-drama or something. And we'll have another live stream soon. Or another episode in person soon.
In person, maybe.
Yeah. We'll make it in person. Sally, thank you so, so much. Mm-hmm. And thank you to everyone who joined. Bye. Have a good night. Bye-bye.